This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Severe weather is nothing new in Indiana. We've experienced our fair share of tornadoes, but how are events like this predicted? And with more technology at our fingertips, can we prepare for it in advance? That's what we're discussing today with a local meteorologist who's been tracking weather for nearly 40 years. With us now is Randy Aulis, Wish TV Channel 8 meteorologist. Welcome to the program, Randy.
Yeah, hi, Miriam. How are you doing on this almost wet afternoon? I got some rain not too far away from us here.
Yeah, it's unusual. It's like there was a heat wave and now it's cold. Right. I mean, what is happening?
Yeah, well, welcome to springtime here across Indiana. You know, last week here, we had a record low of 26 degrees with about 2 to 4 inches of snowfall. It was beautiful, but brought down some tree limbs and things like that. And then yesterday, we were up to 82 degrees, almost a record high. So we've just completely flipped things around in just under a week's time span.
Yeah, it's messing with my allergies. I need consistent weather.
So, me too. We get through the next few weeks here, and hopefully things will start to settle down.
Yeah, well, I do want to learn a little bit real quick about what you do as a meteorologist. You know, we see you on TV. We see, you know, these graphics and stuff like that. But what goes on behind the scenes that people don't know about?
Well, I tell you what, I am a weather model geek. And I really am. Weather's my passion. I'm 65 years old, and I've never met a storm I didn't like. And whenever that day does occur, I'm done. I will hang it up for good. I'm kind of semi-retired right now. But the computer models come in through the National Weather Service. We have a bunch of computer models. Some of them come in like 4 times a day, others 2 times a day. So I'm always on my phone, even before I come into work in the morning, checking out computer models. Sometimes if I wake up in the middle of the night, I'll pull out the phone. I want to see the latest computer run, especially if there's a storm approaching. And for me, it's always a challenge in trying to predict, you know, how much snow is going to fall. When's a tornado going to hit? Things like that. Are we 100% accurate? No. Will we ever be 100% accurate? No. But we've come a long ways over the years here. And I really believe our forecasting skill has greatly improved.
Well, and all the time that you've been covering weather, have you seen major changes in the ability to predict things maybe a little bit more accurately?
Yeah, I think so. In the old days, we used to have the DIFAX weather maps. A lot of people are saying, what's he talking about? Anyway, these are these wet paper models and maps that would come in slowly. Now it's all on your computer. Now you can go on your phone and get everything we get here, you know, just with a click of a button. So things have come a long way. You know, the computer models, the equations, the weather service, they update that every so often. So we've come, you know, pretty far. But again, we don't control the weather. We're never going to hit this 100% of the time. And I tell you, Miriam, I am thankful we don't. Could you imagine if we could control the weather? Talk about weather warfare around the world here. It'd be a bigger mess. So I'm glad we're not in control, but we have come a long ways.
Well, what about, you know, when it comes to predicting weather for the seasons, is that something that generally follows a pattern so you know where things are headed, or are you able to see, you know, differences that are going to come our way? For example, the spring and summer.
Yeah. Well, so far it's been a pretty quiet spring here across Indiana. I mean, we're heading, you know, into tornado season right now. Usually we get our biggest tornadoes during March, April, and May. And, you know, so far it's been pretty quiet here. Now, you go down south, the Gulf Coast states, they've had, you know, several outbreaks of big storms, tornadoes here, some deadly tornadoes, too. Usually the severe weather will start down south and creep northward, and eventually we'll get here. But we've been kind of cool the past couple weeks or so. You know, we had the snow exactly a week ago, and that kind of settles down the atmosphere. But, you know, things are changing. 82 yesterday. Today, rain comes in. And we can get tornadoes really any time of the year. But the big tornadoes, the most intense thunderstorms, March, April, and May. June is a month in which we get the most tornadoes here across Indiana, but weaker tornadoes. So, again, we go into June. That's the peak month for tornadoes right here across the Hoosier State.
Is it looking like it's going to be a pretty calm season? I mean, can you tell that in advance? I guess I'm wondering, like, is there a general pattern? I know you can look back, like, you know, 5 years ago today, the weather was like this.
You know, I've been doing this for over 40 years, and I think the older I get, the more I don't know. You know, as a youngster, I knew everything. Boy, it's going to be a snowy winter, or it's going to be a dry summer, whatever. And there's so many factors involved. You know, they have the computer models. They throw in the data. There's a lot of data that goes in. But there's a lot of things we don't know, too. Those little microclimatisms, as I call them here, mm-hmm. that really makes a difference here in long-range forecasting. We'll look at the ocean temperatures, La Nina, El Nino, especially in trying to predict winter forecasts like this. The Weather Service, they do an okay job, but, a lot of times you could probably do as well just kind of flipping a coin here. And what's interesting about Indiana, we get all four seasons. That's why I love it here. I've been here at Channel 8 since 1984. We have summertime, we have floods, we have drought, we have tornadoes, we have the fall season, we have winter storms, we have ice storms, snow storms, you name it. So we get a little bit of everything right here across Indiana. I enjoy that. I really do.
So there's always something to report on. It's not perfectly sunny every single day.
and no two storms are exactly the same. I know a lot of people say, this reminds me of the winter of 1907, Okay, there may be some similarities to it. But every storm, every winter is different, and we're still in that learning curve here. We got a long ways to go.
Mm-hmm. And has climate change impacted weather in Indiana in all the time that you've been covering weather? Have you noticed, significant changes?
I'm a big believer of cycles. I really am. And I believe that we are to be good stewards of the earth. Don't take that back here. I kind of bugs me when I see somebody throw trash down, I get upset, mm-hmm. go pick it up, somebody's got to pick it up. But, we are to be good stewards of the earth here. And the climate is cyclical. It really is. We go to these warming trends, then we go back down to these cooling trends here. The thing is, though, you want to make sure the warming trends don't get too warm. And I think that's what NASA, does a great job here with the satellite pictures and all the studies they do. And, no pun intended, it's a hot topic. It really is. You have extremes on both sides here of climate change. I respect people's views both ways, but again, we are to be good stewards of the earth, and we don't want to let things get too far out of control.
Right. And so when it comes to climate change in Indiana, I guess I'm wondering, is this summer predicted to be hotter than a summer 20 years ago? Are we seeing the temperature rising slowly as time goes by?
Yeah, I think over the past decade or so, there has been a gradual rise in the temperature, not only, here across Indiana, but really, you look at the reports and probably worldwide. Is it going to continue? I don't know. Again, we have to be good stewards of the earth here. And making a forecast for a month ahead, that's tough. You make the seasonal forecast for 3 months out, that's even tougher. And I know some of these models and that, they'll go 50 years out and say, this is where the sea levels are going to be, this high or that high. And I just shake my head because how computer models are. They change all the time. But again, I do want to emphasize here, I'm a big believer in weather cycles, and I'm a big believer that we are to be good stewards of the earth here. And, I've got 5 grandchildren and, hopefully more on the way. And you want to, leave things halfway in good shape for him here when it's my time to leave the earth.
Right. Absolutely. Right. We should definitely be good stewards of the earth. When it comes to technology, you mentioned that now, people can get these things on their phones, that they can get professional grade Doppler radar and other things on apps. Has that impacted your job in any way? Do you feel like people now maybe think they're experts just because they have an app?
Yeah. I think they think they can do a lot better than what we do. And sometimes they do, they really do. But everything's right there on your phone. You can go there. You can get radar right now. You can go there and get the computer models if you want. You can be your own forecaster. I will say this, Miriam. There's a gentleman, I won't give his full name. His name is John, but I won't say his last name. He did not go to school to become a weather forecaster, but he is a weather geek, and he has trained himself by looking at all these computer models. He's far past me here, especially when it comes to severe storms. So again, if that's your passion in life, there's a lot of ways you can, train yourself here and, try to figure out what's going to happen. Also, too, with the severe weather across Indiana, again, we're in the severe storm season right now. It's always good, to get a Wish TV weather app. You can get these apps on your phone. You can get the National Weather Service watch or warning instantly. In the old days, you had to be watching TV, wait for that crawl to come across here. Or technology right now, they can let you know to the split second when that warning has been issued.
And I'm glad you're bringing this up because I'm wondering, you know, when we get these warnings and our phone suddenly shocks us with some blaring thing and we're like, it looks fine outside. Why is it saying flood watch or warning? I mean, how seriously should we be taking these alerts?
You should take it seriously. And on the old days, they used to put a warning out for a county and it would include the whole county. But now technology, they can just kind of like go into the southern part of that county or whatever. So even though it may be nice where you're at, if they put a warning out, you have to take that seriously. You got to know the difference between a watch and a warning. Also, too, Miriam, let me just say this, too, that you know, people think that hurricanes and tornadoes are it's the greatest killer in our country. It's not. Flooding is the number one killer, and flooding is so dangerous. We always say, turn around, don't drown. It only takes about 1 or 2 feet of water running across a roadway, and especially at night, you don't know if the bridge has been washed out. You don't know how deep the water is, and it only takes about 1 or 2 feet of water. It picks your car up here. The power goes out in your car. Can't get the doors open. You can't get the windows down. And a lot of people driving through flood. So I'll say it again. Kids, never play next to a flooded river or a creek or a stream. Parents, adults, never drive through a flooded roadway. Turn around. Don't drown. Flooding kills more people in this country than hurricanes, tornadoes, and lightning as well.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of flooding, you know, how is that, how dangerous is that here in Indiana?
Yeah, we've had loss of life here with flooding going on. I can't remember what year, but we had the Labor Day flood, which I believe in Indy, we had a record 7+ inches of rainfall in 24 or 36 hours here. I should know the year. I was going to write it down, but I didn't. But flooding is very dangerous, you know, especially if you go down to southern Indiana, you have more hills down there. And again, the flooding may come on quickly. If I can say, too, about tornadoes, I know we're going to run out of time. But some of the biggest tornado outbreaks in our country have occurred right here in Indiana. We had the tri-state tornado back in March of 1925. We had 695 people killed. Palm Sunday outbreak, April 11, 1965. 138 Hoosier lost their life. And the super outbreak of April 3rd and 4th, 1974. We had a total of 47 people killed here in Indiana. So I just say that because flooding, tornadoes, you name it, we get it here. You have to know what to do. You have to know where to go. And you have to take those warnings seriously.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Randy, for joining us and for giving us that information. We'll definitely be paying attention to those alerts when they hit our phones. Randy Aulis, Wish TV, Channel 8 meteorologist. Coming up, how does the state deal with severe weather and natural disasters? Is Indiana prepared to handle these situations? We'll find out after a quick break. We're talking about severe weather in Indiana, prediction and recovery. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soe. Before the break, we heard about severe weather in Indiana, what we might expect, and that weather can be really unpredictable. And natural disasters do seem to be on the rise across the country. And is Indiana prepared if something happens? That's the question we want to find an answer to right now. We're joined by Mary Moran, the Disaster Recovery Director for the Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Mary, as we heard from the meteorologist, Indiana has its fair share of weather events. Some of that may be typical in Indiana, and some things may have the potential to possibly get more severe with climate change. How is the state preparing for such a possibility?
Well, we are constantly monitoring conditions, both the environment and in the man-made environment, and we continuously strive to collect that information, analyze the risks, and then use those risks to determine where our capability gaps might be. And then we also use that information to disseminate information to the public to help them prepare.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the Department of Homeland Security, how does disaster recovery relief fit into things?
Okay. One of our main missions with Department of Homeland Security is life and property. And we house the Emergency Operations Center in our agency, which is the coordination point for any emergency or disaster event that happens. And that is where all our disaster response and recovery activities start. Whenever an event occurs or if we are anticipating event, all of that runs through the Emergency Response and Recovery Division of our agency.
Is Indiana the only location that has this kind of a department, or is this in every state?
No, pretty much every state has a version of either Homeland Security or an emergency management agency.
Okay. Okay. So this is, are you in place of an emergency management agency? Is it called Homeland Security? I just want to make sure I'm clear.
Oh, no, we actually, the portion that I manage is the emergency management agency for the state, and we are just housed within the Department of Homeland Security, along with the Fire and Building Services and the EMS and several other divisions.
Okay. And when it comes to your department, you know, how do you deal with severe weather events? You know, what is your role?
Well, what we do is we spend a lot of time monitoring conditions in other states or other areas around us to see what is happening. We are continuously monitoring media, the weather reports. We have regular conference calls with the National Weather Service in preparation for flooding events or severe weather events. So those are just a few of the things that we do to get ready. A lot of it is information collection, and then we just work with our partners that we think may be involved in the event to alert them that we may be needing their assistance.
And what are the agencies that you collaborate with, let's say, during a severe weather event or even the aftermath?
We have ones that we normally work with all of the time. They are the Indiana State Police, Indiana Department of Transportation, Indiana Department of Environmental Management, and Indiana Department of Natural Resources. Those are the ones that we normally work with no matter what the event. And then we work with communication, Fire Chiefs Association. It depends on what partner we utilize is specific to whatever event is occurring.
So let's say there is severe flooding. What would the day look like for your department, and how would they assist people?
Okay, so when a flooding event is predicted to happen, we monitor it and we decide whether we need to change the activation level of our emergency operations center. And what that does is, as we escalate the activation, we bring in more partners. So let's say that, you know, a rain has been forecast, and we know that it's going to be a pretty heavy rainfall in a very short duration of time. And we know pretty much the areas where it's going, and we have historical knowledge of what the impacts have been from like events. So we will start alerting the local partners or calling in our own partners to just be in a forward-leaning position for when the event actually does happen.
And you know, have you had any, I guess, memorable events that have occurred where, I mean, maybe you weren't prepared and all of a sudden this thing happened and you guys had to spring to action and it all came together?
Yes, that while we do get warning when it comes to tornadoes and straight line winds and that sort of thing, they can also happen with very little notice. And what happens then is, as soon as a local community starts to report their impacts or damages, they start reporting that to our emergency operations center, and then we start collecting all that information to provide a governor's briefing to the governor so he can decide what emergency actions he would like to take, if any, are necessary.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the response, you know, working with different officials on this? You know, are you providing them all the information about what's going on, and how receptive are they to that, to taking some kind of action?
Luckily, Indiana has a very strong coordination between our state and our local communities when it comes to that kind of activities. In fact, we've even built those partnerships up through our COVID-19 work that we've been doing for the past year and a half. So, yes, we do collect that information. We gather the information from our partners, and I think it works really well.
There's been some talk recently that, you know, some states are not prepared for likely increases in natural disasters. For example, we saw what happened in Texas with the ice storm. Where does Indiana fall in that category?
Well, Indiana has been forward-leaning. We create what is called the State Hazard Mitigation Plan, where we analyze the risks, both what we have now and what we foresee in the future. And we have a pretty robust climate resiliency portion of that plan. And we've worked with we work with National Weather Service. We work with several educational institutions to build up our capability.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to funding, how do you get funding for the work that you do? And when does federal aid kick in?
Well, we exist on legislative funding and grant funding. And when it comes to a particular event, like say we have a big flood, the way the disaster recovery works is Indiana has to go out at both the local and the state level and do what we call damage assessments. And that's where we catalog the damage and the impacts of any event. We produce a report from that we give to the governor's office, and then we, through our executive staff, sit down and analyze what level of disaster recovery may be available. If a county uses up all its resources, there is state disaster relief resources, and then when the state utilizes all its resources, we have the capacity through the governor's office to request the federal assistance through the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And they come with funding to help both jurisdictions and individuals recover.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today about severe weather and how the state works to help communities recover from events like tornadoes and floods. If you have any questions or comments on the topic, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Mary, I'm curious, is there anything about your job that you think people don't really know or understand? You know, like you're talking to people about what you do. What are some common misconceptions?
Well, one of the things, they have some misconceptions of the difference between the state Homeland Security and the federal Homeland Security as far as, you know, immigration and naturalization and those sort of things. And then another piece that I find is there are a lot of people that aren't aware of all the risks that exist in Indiana. Like we have a fairly significant earthquake risk that we work on, and that's not common knowledge in a lot of areas.
Well, I do want to talk about that earthquake. You've piqued my interest here. What is the status of earthquakes in Indiana? How worried should we be?
Well, maybe not worried, but leaning forward to prepare, because we are impacted by the New Madrid Fault, and we are impacted by the Wabash Valley Seismic Zone. And they could historically, in fact, the New Madrid historically has one of the biggest earthquakes on record in the continental United States. And so we definitely would be impacted if another event like that were to occur. So we work with the federal government and the partnering other states impacted by those zones to do emergency and catastrophic planning for those events.
And so you guys are measuring and watching, I'm assuming, this earthquake activity through these partnerships. Is there anything that you've seen recently that looks like it's coming to life? It's going to start shaking at some point?
No, luckily we haven't. There's some action on it every day or most days, but they're, you know, very small on the faults. But we never know when. That was one of the events that you mentioned that we will have probably no warning on. So we try and prep for that as much as we can.
Is the infrastructure even prepared for something like an earthquake?
Well, I think like Texas, if we were to have this kind of event, we would definitely have some infrastructure challenges. But again, we as a state are working every day with our partners and through grant funding and projects to increase our resiliency.
I find it interesting. I'm not trying to keep picking at this earthquake thing, but I'm thinking about places like San Francisco or areas where they have these historic earthquakes and buildings are now built to withstand these things. Is that something that, that Hoosiers should consider, let's say, if they're building a home or if a company is building a building to put in measures to keep it earthquake proof? Or is that already part of the plan here in Indiana?
It is not. Some of the details when it comes to earthquake preparedness are not written into code, but I would definitely encourage people to look into it because there are things that you can do for your home that are very inexpensive, like know where your emergency gas shutoff valve is for your house. If you have things hung on the wall that are heavy, that could potentially, you know, cause a falling injury, attach those to the walls. Earthquake preparedness can be very, very inexpensive, but there are significant reports that show that for every dollar we spend in that kind of preparedness, we are saving between $6 and $8 in recovery costs.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, I'm one of those people who has no idea what to do in an earthquake. I'm like, do you just run out of the building? You know, what is the best measure for someone if they find themselves in that situation?
Well, what I would encourage is, and that we try and encourage folks, the mindset used to be to run outside. Well, we found that, you know, there were things falling off of buildings that caused risks. The best advice I can give to everyone is go to ready.gov and explore all of the different hazards and all of the different suggestions, because what you can do to prepare for an earthquake can also help you prepare for several other hazards.
Mm-hmm. And are there any weather hazards that are, I guess, more likely to happen that we can be better prepared for? For example, we've talked about flooding and tornadoes. And if so, you know, what are some tips for those?
Yes, as Randy mentions, flooding is our most deadliest and our most costliest risk factor here in Indiana. So some of the things you can do if personal preparedness. One of the biggest things I can tell you is insurance. Look at flood insurance. Look at flood insurance even if you don't live in a special flood hazard area. Look at earthquake insurance. It's very inexpensive because we aren't considered in a high-risk area. I would also encourage, for weather-specific, one thing we tout very much is having a weather radio because you can program those to only get the alerts for your zip code. So it's not constantly going off, and that will give you the most up-to-date information. And then the other thing is that we always encourage, and there's lots of information on that ready.gov site, is a family preparedness kit with medicines and important documents and a family reunification plan. If you get separated, where's a place you might meet, that sort of thing.
And are you seeing an increase in these severe weather events, as we spoke with Randy earlier about climate change and things like that? I mean, are you seeing an actual tangible impact here in Indiana?
I think after reading some studies, we have definitely noticed a trend in more frequent severe events. And when it comes to especially our flood risk, we are seeing more systems bringing higher amounts of precipitation in a shorter amount of time, which then leads to flash flooding issues and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely have seen that.
I was going to say, can you tell us about flash flooding for folks,
yes,
who may not know that?
And here's one of the reasons why I encourage flood insurance, because a lot of the time flash flooding happens in areas where there is no body of water that floods. In fact, we had a community that received like 8 inches of water in a 4-hour time frame, and there were no rivers where this community was impacted. So with flash flooding, it can happen very quickly, and it can be very deadly. As Randy mentioned, those are the events where we have people not gauging the depth of water on a road and driving in and then are leading to fatalities. And the other thing with flash flooding is it's much more dangerous for our first responders, like the folks we sent out to do water rescues. It's more dangerous for them.
Mm-hmm. And what about as we're heading into sort of some severe weather season with tornadoes and such? What is your department doing to plan for potential events?
Well, one thing that our agency does is we have a whole section of our agency that does nothing but disseminate public information. So we are already starting to push out, you know, flooding messages. And if you're going to be recreating on the water, here are some tips to do it safely. We are continually pushing out information, and then we are continually using our grant funding to do projects that make communities more resilient even before a disaster happens.
Mm-hmm. And real quick, any other last tips you would like to give to our audience, I guess, when it comes to tornadoes, something that they should or should not do?
One thing that is misnomer, don't shut your windows. Leave the windows open. One, it wastes valuable time, and two, it serves no purpose. So don't do that. But again, I'm going to encourage the weather radio. Take those watches and warnings very seriously, and stay away from floodwaters.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Mary Moran, the Disaster Recovery Director for the Indiana Department of Homeland Security. We'll be back after a quick break when we'll shift gears to the legacy of beloved Bobby Slick Leonard, the first coach of the Indiana Pacers. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soh, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. The beloved first coach of the Indiana Pacers has left quite a legacy here in the state. Bobby Slick Leonard passed away earlier this month at the age of 88. For those of us who aren't immersed in sports, we may have heard of him, but not know exactly why he had such an impact on the state and basketball. So with us now to help us understand all of this is Indianapolis-based author and sports journalist Mark Monti. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Mark, before we get started talking about Bobby Leonard, can you help us out here so we're all on familiar ground? What is the ABA?
Well, the American Basketball Association was formed in 1967. There really was a market for it. The NBA at that time only had 9-10 teams, and there were a lot of college All-Americans who weren't even able to make an NBA roster. So some people came up with the idea of forming a new league in 1967, the American Basketball Association, and Indianapolis was one of the charter members. So it gave an opportunity to a lot of people, players and coaches, to get into professional basketball, and Bobby Slick Leonard happened to be one of those. He was working up in Kokomo as a sales representative for Herf Jones, selling graduation supplies to high schools in the northern part of the state when the ABA was formed, and a year later he got back into coaching.
Wow. And so you say he got back into coaching. What made him take time off?
Well, he had played 7 years in the NBA and for a while was technically a player coach for the Chicago Zephyrs. And that franchise moved to Baltimore. He was the coach of the Baltimore Bullets for a year. Had a young team. They weren't really equipped to win. And he got let go in 1964 by the Baltimore Bullets. So at that point, he thinks he's out of basketball. He and his wife, Nancy, and they had a couple kids at that point, moved to Kokomo to begin working for Herf Jones by his choice. But he seemed to be comfortable with that arrangement. He was doing well as a sales rep. Nancy is teaching business classes at Kokomo Taylor High School, and they have settled into a life outside of basketball and perfectly happy doing just that. He was associated with the Pacers when they began in 1967, but didn't have any interest in coaching the team because he didn't know if this new league was going to survive. You know, there had been an attempt to start a second professional basketball league in the early 60s, the American Basketball League, and it folded after a year and a half. And a lot of people assumed that the ABA would do the same thing. So he kind of kept an eye on it, and he helped with open tryouts and so forth. He attended games, but he didn't want to give up a steady job for this new league. So when he saw the potential of the roster the Pacers had accumulated in that second season and they got off to a slow start, at that point he was willing to jump back in and coach the team, but he did not give up his sales job with Herf Jones. He did both jobs for a couple of years.
And so, you know, I'm curious because I'm not super sports literate here. so what happened to the ABA, and how did the NBA become like the known entity for basketball?
Yeah, well, the NBA was there all along, and it was, you know, really the superior league. It should have been. It had been formed, you know, roughly around 1950, and it was well established. The ABA was the upstart league. It accumulated talent by signing players before their college eligibility had expired, and the NBA had a rule about doing that. So they would take players who had not finished college or who left after a couple years of college, that kind of thing. Some of the great players like Julius Erving, who left college early, and also some of the guys who got second chances who had been cut by NBA teams were able to get a foothold in the ABA. But the ABA didn't have enough major marketplaces. You know, it had teams in, you know, Virginia and North Carolina, or places where basketball just hadn't become a big deal yet. So the ABA survived for 9 years and gradually just kind of imploded. You know, it just didn't have the ownership, the financial backing to survive any longer than that. So in 1976, four of the ABA teams were merged into the NBA and the others just dropped off.
And one of those teams was the Pacers, correct? That got merged.
Right.
And what was that like for them? I mean, they were successful in the ABA and then they became part of the NBA.
Yeah, it was at the time of the merger, the Pacers were not very good. You know, their championship teams, the players on those teams had aged and moved on, and the Pacers were in a rebuilding situation when the ABA merged into the NBA. So they were down, you know, and they did not draw well in their first NBA season. They just weren't a very good team. Part of the natural cycle of professional sports, where if you do get to be good, your players age and then get over the hill and you have to rebuild with younger players. So their first year in the NBA didn't go particularly well. That's when they had the famous telethon to save the Pacers in July of 1977, the July 4th weekend in 1977, the telethon was held to raise money to save the Pacers.
And how did Coach Leonard fit into this in the early days of the Pacers? How was he instrumental in shaping this team?
Well, he changed the culture. You know, the Pacers had their original coach, Larry Staverman, nice guy, had some playing experience and so forth. He'd been an assistant coach at Notre Dame. The Pacers had kind of an average team their first season. They made a great trade in the offseason that improved the talent, bringing in future Hall of Famer Mel Daniels, but they still got off to a slow start. So that second year, the Pacers are 2-7 when Bobby Slick Leonard is hired to take over the team, and he changed the culture. And I have a book called Reborn, The Pacers and the Return to Professional Basketball at the Indianapolis. And one of the things it does is detail how he changed the culture. His very first practice as the Pacers coach was at Brebeuf High School. There were some reporters there, and they detailed how he ran that practice. He just ramped up the intensity. He wasn't afraid to get on players, but at the same time, he knew how to communicate with players. So the essence of Slick Leonard's coaching success, and I think for any coach in any sport, you have to be able to drive the players, to kick them in the butt, so to speak, but at the same time, you got to be able to throw an arm around them and encourage them and communicate with them and listen to them. And that's what Slick Leonard did. So he changed the culture of the Pacer franchise in that second year. They went from a team that was 2-7 to reaching the ABA finals in 1969, not winning the championship, but reaching the finals. And that led to three championships over the course of the next four seasons.
And was his coaching style emulated at all by any other coaches? Did he influence that sort of profession at all?
I would think so. But, you know, it's hard to do that because you have to have a certain personality. Every coach has to coach within his or her personality, and you can't fake it. And that's one thing that Slick Leonard often says is you can't fool the players. You can't be a phony. You know, you've got to be sincere in your desire for the Pacers or for the players to perform well, you know, to make a living, you got to really care about them as players and people. And if you don't have that within your personality, you can't do that. So a lot of budding coaches out there probably saw Slick Leonard ranting and raving on the sidelines, kicking balls into the stands, yelling at the officials, you know, being really emotional, they might have tried to emulate that. But unless they could also emulate the more private aspects of his coaching, the communication with players, you know, the way he connected with them individually, they were not going to succeed.
And are there any players who credit him with influencing their life in some way?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Even beyond players, you know, obviously he helped guys get better. The teams became good, and that was good for the players' careers. But I think it's fair to say that he was a father figure for some of the players. A guy like Bob Nedelecki, who did not have a close relationship with his father. You know, he was a guy that Slick Leonard often said, I had to be on him all the time. You know, I had to always be kicking him in the behind to get him going. You know, I think it's fair to say that Slick was a father figure for him. And there are some other guys who maybe had grown up in a single parent household or did not have a close relationship with their father. And Slick would qualify as a father figure for them as well. Now, for the guys who had a strong father, you know, they didn't need that, but they still saw him as an authority figure that they were willing to listen to and go along with. They might have rebelled at times. They might have disagreed with him at times. They might have gotten tired of him at times. But on the whole, you know, they did respect his leadership and fell in line behind him. And that worked out well, obviously, for the team.
And how long was the coach with the Pacers?
Well, he coached for 12 seasons. He took over in that early 68-69 season in the ABA and coached up through the 79-80 season in the NBA. And at that time was let go. You know, the talent had dropped off. There was a rebuilding mode. The Pacer ownership had changed. They were owned by a man in California who, number one, didn't really have the money to finance an NBA team, but also, you know, didn't have a personal connection with Slick Leonard or even really with the fans of Indianapolis. You know, he's a guy from California. So I think by that time, Slick, he'd had enough. You know, he'd done it for a long time. He was kind of burned out. So he left the team in 1980 at the end of that season, replaced by a man named Jack McKinney, who actually took the Pacers to the playoffs the next season. The Pacers made the NBA playoffs for the first time in 1981. So looking back on it, it was probably time for a change, but he did last, you know, from 1968 to 1980, and that's a lifetime in the coaching life of an NBA coach.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that makes his legacy so profound, even though, you know, he left the coaching back, you said, in 1980, what is it that, you know, his passing has really, I don't know, it spurred a lot of emotion in people and reaction?
Right. He had a second, really a third career as a broadcaster. You know, he had been a player. He'd been a great player at Indiana University. He'd played in the NBA in Chicago and L.A. and Minneapolis. Then he became a Pacers coach and kind of cemented his legacy then. But then, you know, he's let go in 1980. But in 1985, he comes back as a broadcaster for the Pacers, first as an analyst for their television broadcasts, and then later, in the early 90s, on the radio. And so he became really famous to generations of fans as a radio personality, as a color analyst for the broadcasts. And his personality shone through in those broadcasts, his enthusiasm, his down-home approach, his blunt honesty, those kind of things. So there are generations of Pacer fans who really only know him as a broadcaster. But he became well known for that, and that really kind of cemented his popularity with fans of all ages. And then beyond that, even, it was his personality. You know, he was such an approachable guy, such a low ego guy for somebody who had had great success as a player and coach and was well known as a broadcaster. He was a low ego guy who was great for media people like myself to work with, but he was also approachable by fans. He would sit outside the radio area at Bankers Life Fieldhouse before games, and fans would come up and get autographs and get pictures with him. And he would talk to everyone like they were his best friend. He would go out at halftime. There's a smoker's porch at Bankers Life Fieldhouse where people can go outside the building and smoke a cigarette. And Slick would go out there at halftime, even when he was in a wheelchair in later years. He would go out there and smoke a cigarette and, you know, talk with fans, sign an autograph for whatever. I occasionally took a fan from Japan or China who was here visiting and going to a Pacer game out to meet Slick Leonard out on the smoker's porch. So he was just eminently approachable by everyone, always willing to lend a hand to somebody or advice or whatever. The bottom line, I think, of his popularity was simply his personality.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like he had quite an international following. It's interesting because we don't always often think about people outside of the U.S. as watching basketball. I mean, I know it's grown over the decades, but in general, it's just like, oh, people are interested in basketball coaches from Indiana.
Yeah, you know, the game is televised, of course, worldwide now. So there are fans in China, Japan, South America, all through Europe. And there are Pacer fans all over the world, largely because of Reggie Miller. I mean, the Reggie Miller heroics in the late 90s attracted fans from particularly Asian countries. And I think they really connected with Reggie because he wasn't an athletic guy. He was a skinny guy who wasn't a great athlete by NBA standards. And he, you know, beat the dreaded New York Knicks in the playoffs and had great playoff moments as a smart player and a clutch player. And so the Pacers attracted a following because of him, and those fans would listen to games on the radio, you know, through the internet in their home countries, and they got to know Slick Leonard that way. So when they came to Indianapolis for a game, which they would do as often as their finances allowed, they wanted to meet Slick. And he was always happy to meet a new fan.
That's pretty cool. What about, you know, did Coach Leonard ever say anything about not winning a championship in the NBA for the Pacers?
Yeah, it was a frustrating thing for him. I mean, he knew that the teams he coached had no chance simply because, number one, they're going through the cycle of older players retiring and bringing in younger players, complicated by the fact the ownership didn't have really the money to keep the better players or sign the better players as free agents. So the teams he coached, and he coached, four NBA teams, they had no chance to win a championship. In fact, his last five teams as the Pacer coach had a losing record. He just didn't have the talent, and he would be the one to admit you've got to have the talent to win. It's not just all coaching. So he, you know, left with five losing seasons, no chance to win a championship, and certainly as a broadcaster wanted nothing more than for the Pacers to win an NBA championship, and it just never happened. You know, they won conference championships. They got to the NBA Finals in 2000, and he was, you know, really enthusiastic about all that. But it just didn't happen, and, you know, it was outside of his control.
And you mentioned you've written a book about this. What are some – I mean, we're getting ready to wrap up, but is there, like, a specific, I don't know, story that stood out to you?
Well, I think just the way he connected with the players. You know, I did write about the very first practice he conducted as the Pacers coach in November 1968. And, you know, how he just got on the players and told one guy, you know, don't ever shoot from there again, that kind of thing. And you're not going to get me fired like you got him fired. He invited the previous coach to that practice and said, you're not going to get me fired like him, you know, this kind of thing. He, you know, he was aggressive with the players. But as time went on, you could tell that he knew how to communicate with the players and give them confidence. You know, one of his great lines as a coach when you were on the road, the Pacers won three ABA championships and all of the clinching games came on the road, which is really unusual because we hear so much about home court advantage in the NBA playoffs. Pacers won their ABA titles on the road, and Slick would always tell the guys, walk out there like you own the damn place. You know, that's the way he gave guys confidence, you know, no fears, no tears, this kind of thing. And that was really the way he inspired the players, you know, go out there like you own the damn place. Don't be afraid of what their fans are doing or saying or anything like that. So I think the book captures a lot of that. And, you know, that's what his players remember most about him.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share with us Coach Bobby Slick Leonard's legacy. Mark Monteith is an author and sports journalist based in Indianapolis. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Join us tomorrow as we recap the 2021 Indiana legislative session. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.